Hello, and welcome to the Pink Bike Podcast. I'm your host for today, Sarah Moore, since Henry Quinney is still in Fort William after watching the first World Cup. But I have Mike Kazmer here and Dario DiGiulio. So thanks for joining me, guys. Did you both watch the race this weekend?
I did, yes.
You betcha.
What'd you think?
It was a good race.
Yeah, it was pretty exciting. Valley Hole came out on top for the women's race. I thought Nina Hoffman had it after she came down. That was a really, really good run. And I think she maybe thought she had it too, until Valley got to the finish line. There was a video I saw of her reactions, and she really was hoping for that win. But yeah,
she was on her knees.
Yeah. Valley Hole came out on top, and really cool to see Tawny Seagrave and Camille Blanche in the women's race, both coming back from serious head injuries and back in third and fourth. So yeah, that was pretty wild that they can just come back and still be on the top of the game. And then fifth place for the women was Gloria Scarsi, who I don't know if we've seen her on the World Cup podium yet. So yeah, that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
And then the men's racing, Loic Bruni.
I know, Bruni. He's so smooth. In practice and everything, he just looked like Mr. Smooth. Then he just lays down the run. He's just never. It's so perfect that it's almost annoying how perfect it is, but it's also just incredibly impressive. Oh yeah, that's how you should do it.
Yeah, and 10 races, I think, at Fort William that he's done, I think I read, before he was able to take the win. So You kind of think of him as being able to, win anywhere. And yeah, it just took him a long time to piece together the Fort William track. So pretty cool to see. And then poor Troy Brosnan,
second place. No, he's king of seconds. I mean, that's where I knew he would finish. But I was Troy, he's so good. He's so consistent. He probably has more second place finishes. I'd be willing to bet more second place finishes than anyone ever in World Cups.
Yeah, at least he wasn't pipped at the line.
He also has three wins.
Yeah,
I know, but he's been doing it for a long time. You just want to see him win because he's so fast and so good. But then he's just battling Bruni, and Bruni right now is just the person to beat. Obviously, it's
And his Finn Isles did get just pipped by Troy though right at the end. But at least he wasn't pipped for the win. The win was a solid almost 2 seconds that was taken over. So that was pretty cool. And then
I thought Dak Norton had it. His run was so good, and he was taking pretty bold lines, middle of the course, that were working out for him. And I was he's going to win. And then it just kept ratcheting up. It was a really good crescendo in that way.
Yeah. And Americans in fourth and fifth. So Dakota in fourth, and then Luca back on the podium in fifth, which I think it's been a while. I know it's been a while. I feel since we've seen Luca on the podium. So it'd be cool if he found his speed again.
Three North Americans too,
It's gonna be a good season.
Yeah, yeah, in cross country racing, and then now in downhill, the Americans are coming back strong. So pretty cool podiums both in the men's and women's races. And then first round is usually a pretty cool one for tech. Saw Bruni had some little covers on his disc brakes. What was going on there?
He had his Game Boy controller.
He had disc brake covers, which they said it was because they wanted to protect the disc brake from water to maintain brake consistency, but there was no water on the track. But I wonder if it's some sort of aero thing. Specialized does have a wind tunnel, and they do aero testing. And I wonder if they've just figured out that that's a little bit of an advantage, or it could just mind games. He could just be messing with everybody just to be like, hey, look,
there's
I did
also
this,
if you watch the last guys down the hill had quite a bit of fog come in. I wonder if maybe that's enough moisture for them to care.
Just want it consistent. He was running a longer fender, I think, than anybody also. He was doing, I think they're just maybe worried that if the rain came, he just wanted to be that, keep that precision going. But
I guess maybe last time at the World Champs, he got he got stuck in the rain for the last run, and the fog was kind of coming in and out there, so maybe he was just I want to be doubly prepared this year in case the rain does come down.
I wouldn't doubt it. He wants everything perfect, and then he's got his whole the Game Boy controllers, we were saying. He's got three buttons. Him and Finn are running three buttons that control their shock and four buttons, actually. They have three buttons on the left side, then another button on the right side. So you have four different buttons to mess with to control your suspension. But when you look at Loic sprinting through the final motorway section, his bike looked nearly locked out. It was super firm. So
I think it's because the Ohlins shocks have 1-2-3 high speed compression. My guess is they just correspond to that. And then the right one is just fork.
Fork. Yeah.
Yeah.
that's a lot to keep in your head when you're trying to go 9,000 miles an hour and like also clear the road gaps and things. And like, it's, they're doing,
I mean,
some
every,
stuff now.
Like all the like main sponsor RockShox athletes had some form of flight attendant on their bikes, but theirs was just like a single toggle, or they were running it like full brain mode.
Yeah. Automatic. Yeah. And then Asa had one too on his, he's running that Frameworks at Seattle. Yeah. We saw a version of the Frameworks that had the, Fox's Rad Shock, but same thing, has a little remote on the left hand side that you can toggle it to locked out or unlocked. So Asa had that. Yeah. So even the juniors have the fancy electronic stuff now too.
Yeah. And the juniors are going really fast. I think, Asa, we published an article like 2 months ago that he had broken, I think, his hip.
It was like less than 6 weeks, I think.
Yeah, it was really recent.
And I saw that he was like going to the race, and I was like, oh yeah, he's just kind of like going for the experience of the new team. And it's like, no, I'm going for the win, and like could have got like a top
decisive
10,
win too.
Yeah.
Like apparently he was like half a second slower than Bruni on that motorway at the end. So so I don't think we can put that all down to just having the right technology.
No, not at all. Yeah, it's great to see the juniors coming up. It's just going to be tight racing for a long time now, which is really neat.
Yeah.
We should talk a little bit about the coverage and the commentary, because obviously our commentators have been going hard and just saying that everything Discovery and Warner Brothers is horrible, which I don't agree with, but there's definitely room for improvement. Like I'll say for myself, watching it was easy. Like here in America, I was able to just go to HBO and watch it, which is cool. You do have to subscribe to HBO, but like I found watching it was easy. I think we might have had a nice commenter put a link somewhere that made it easy for everyone else to watch also. But as far as like the actual coverage, I felt like I was watching it from the moon at times. And it just, there wasn't a lot of energy for a really exciting race. Like
I know.
You almost need to like commentate it in your head to be like, this is really exciting, instead of like, well, this will be his, he's riding a Trek Remedy. And you're like, it's not even a Remedy. Like at one point they called it a Trek Remedy. And I was like, what do you
mean? Yeah, just me. Cause like I was, like the cross country races just had like such amazing energy, and I was like so excited when I was
following
them.
We're used to
them.
That with downhill too.
Like, and like I was like, oh, am I just like not as interested in what's going on? And I was like, no, I think it's like the commentating. Like they were like the sound was kind of like quieter, and then
they're like chatting. Like no, I want someone screaming.
Yeah, she's excited. Yeah. Maybe because it's like it is a long race. I think the 4 minute course probably makes it harder because you have to like fill dead air, but also because they are looking from far away. Like they didn't even notice when Menara crashed because the view is so far away. Like he just blended in with the rocks. Like his first gnarly crash that I think it's on the Pink Bike Instagram now, but like you can barely see it. But then they picked it up later when he ate shit again. But yeah, I think they need to maybe drink Red Bull. Like,
they also need, they needed more splits. That was my biggest beef. Yeah, totally. There were like four splits down that whole track.
Yeah.
And even at one point, Gwyn was like, I sure would love more splits. Like,
the first
they're
split
just
comes
waiting.
It comes at 250, I think, for some a lot of riders.
They have like, there's like one at 40 seconds and then one at 2 minutes and 15. And so there's like a minute and a half of the most important part of the track.
Yeah.
Where they're just kind of speculating as to how fast the person's going
without even really seeing any video.
No,
correct.
Like speculating based on like kind of like it almost all looked like motorway too from like the way it was just filmed.
The way
that
they shot
like,
it for sure.
Like, oh man, I want to see more of the technical stuff. Like,
and it's so rough too. Like, there's a one shot they kept showing that all you saw was the grass. Like the camera would pan and you just saw grass, and then the rider would pop out the other side and you saw nothing. Like, what did you even?
Yeah. Or the gondola. We kept seeing the gondola.
Yeah, it's like,
I like the gondola shot because you'd see a person in the gondola like whip to the side and realize they were on camera.
I mean, hopefully they can. I want them to figure it out because it's such a good sport to watch and can be so exciting. They just have to make it.
Well, I was thinking like it's a hard race for the athletes to start at because it's so long. But then I was also thinking like it's a pretty hard one to start as a broadcaster as well, because it's like it is really long. You can't show as much as like some other race courses.
Yeah, physically, and just like a long course, like as opposed to being steep and tight, it's just like miles and miles and miles of cable to run.
Yeah.
Given it's like mostly not in woods, so it should be easier for them to do.
Yeah.
Good
shots.
It's also
been a race for 40 years now, I feel like. Like they must know where the good spot is to set up cameras. Like, I mean, they know it's a new crew, but I mean, I think they'll hopefully, they've got to figure it out. But like, yeah, just, I mean, I think some of the hate towards the coverage is not justified, but there's definitely complaints that are justified. I think they just need to make it an exciting, fun thing to watch. Like, just a little more prep, a little more excitement. Like, I don't know, even sound, I don't even know. The sound was weird at some points. There were kind of like that fake sound effects thing at one. Like, it's a weird, I don't know if it's fake, but it's like the sound doesn't line up and
the
it just is really
strange. Yeah, yeah.
I think there are fake sound effects too. I need to dig in more, but there's weird stuff happening. Either way, great race coverage could still be better. There was some great, some really good coverage, but also some not as good. And I do, I'm glad that Gwyn's in there, because without Gwyn, I think that it'd be a huge snooze fest. So
yeah, for sure. He like has all the rich history behind you know, at least half of the field, and like I think the biggest learning moment for Warner Brothers is going to be realizing that most people don't want to see the jumps. They want to see the tech.
Yeah, exactly. Like, get it on the tech stuff.
They do a good job of covering like motorway and like final jump stuff. Like those were like thoroughly shot the whole way through. But
I think that's what they use the drone, which the drone a lot of times can be annoying. Like the drone in the woods doesn't work, but they were able to have the drone on the thing. But they'll figure it out, I hope. We got 2 weeks, right? Like 2 weeks. You'll get the next one, Dario, so you can tell them what to do. You just go up there and start
like, hey guys, I got an idea. Yeah, the next one will be interesting because it's a new course, like the new country even. So, you know, no, they've never had a World Cup in Poland. They've never shot this town. It will be, you know, room for growth, hopefully.
Yeah. What are you looking forward to seeing when you're there?
Everything. I'm so excited.
Pierogies.
Pierogies. Kielbasa, Gawumpki, and the riding in the area seems cool. I like, there's a lot of stuff on Trail Forks there, but there's zero way to tell what it is. So I think I have a sense of what the downhill course will be. Like, there's like one lift, there's two lift access parks in the area, and it looks like they're like kind of stitching together a couple of the trails in one of the existing parks. I'm stoked to see what the course is. Like, no clue.
Yeah, it'd be cool. It's always nice, a fresh venue too. The athletes don't have it memorized. You know, like Fort William, there are people that have done it dozens and dozens of times. So now no one knows what it'll be like. So hopefully it's a good course and it'd be cool.
Yeah.
And I'm glad we don't have to wait like a month.
Yeah. The people who aren't local to Fort William have done it for, you know, decades.
Right.
So,
Yeah, this will be brand new. And you think we'll see any more tech there, or what are you looking for?
Yeah, I think, I bet depending on the nature of the riding, I mean, setup will change a ton. It, from what I can tell, it's like more like forested kind of soft soil place. So about as different from Fort William as you can get setup wise. So tires, wheels, you know, settings obviously change, but like, I think it'll be cool. I'm super curious to see what looks different on people's bikes.
Yeah, be interested to see how many people keep using electronic suspension, or how they decide to use it between, depending on the courses, you know, like Fort William makes sense because it has the smooth, flatter part in the, not flatter, but like smooth jumps in the end, but not all courses are like that. So
yeah, like Leogang, they'll probably run that again, but like, who knows what Poland looks like.
And we'll just see what Bruni keeps doing, and if other people try doing weird things. And then the speed suit thing too, which is that we didn't really talk about that, but that was the controversy of this one. People are wearing extra tight clothes this year, which is funny. Yeah. I like that. It was, Troy and Luca wearing their Pink Panther outfits. They were calling
them sick.
Yeah.
I liked those. Like,
yeah, it's good. So yeah, it'd be fun to see what happens next.
And it's not a skin suit though, right? What's the technicality?
The speed suit. Two pieces. It's real tight.
Martin May's on his e-bike. Henry did an interview with him, so I'm excited to listen to that. And should be an exciting race season for Martin May's. We'll see if he's like doing enduro and some
I was gonna say, do we know if he's doing the full calendar?
As far as I know, I don't think he's doing, hopefully in the interview that's coming up, we'll find out, but I'm pretty sure he's doing enduro and then select downhill events.
Yeah, I feel like if he was doing all the downhill calendar, they would have made him a specific downhill bike. I mean, that was impressive.
I know, he plays well.
Sweet. Okay, well, let's get into that.
Martin, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for making time in what is, I think, a pretty exciting week. Season opener, Fort William, and you're racing downhill again. That's pretty exciting, right?
Yeah, thanks, Harry. Thanks for having me. It's my pleasure to be in this podcast. Yeah, absolutely, Fort William. I've raced here so many times, and it's the first official race of the season with an exciting project that we have. I'm just excited to be here, trying to do my best with a product which we don't have a lot of feedback from. But no matter what, I will try to do my best, like for every race.
When I think of sort of areas likely to produce great mountain bikers, and this might be complete ignorance on my behalf, Belgium isn't necessarily top of that list for whatever reason. Because in my head, I think, you know, amazing road cycling scene, amazing cyclocross scene, but not necessarily with the mountains and everything you would need to produce a world-class mountain biker. Then again, I'm sure people probably think that of England, and we do have enough hills and whatnot to generate the talent. What is the Belgian mountain bike scene like, and what was it like growing up there? Was there access to real kind of mountain bike and enduro trails?
Yeah, actually, I don't think it's as bad as what we think. Obviously, there is the North Path that is very famous for all the road cycling races, which are very flat indeed. But where I live in the south, there is actually much more elevation than what we think. So we are talking about 200, 250 meters of elevation, which is enough actually to have a stage or a downhill of a few minutes, talking about 1.5, 2.5 minutes. Or if you research for it on the technical side, on the slow side, you might end up with a stage of 3 minutes maximum. But that's, I believe that's enough to progress. We've been able to dig some trails. Now we have a few trail centers in my region, which are good and offer some good ridings. So actually, I've never complained about living in Belgium, because I have enough to be able to progress. Yes, we don't have long stages or big elevation, but that's something that I try to work on when I go abroad during the winter in the training camps, to have a bit more length and get the body used to it. But in parallel, I ride a lot of motos. So I'm able to actually work on the length of the intensity, you know, the intensity and the length of the effort that I don't necessarily get on the mountain bike. And also we have an advantage compared to other region, is during the winter, during the off season, it's a lot of rain, it's a lot of mud. So actually you forced to ride in, let's say, shit conditions, but I believe that makes you better riders. When you come back to dry soil or dry conditions, you feel like everything is easy. So compared to like the Kiwis or Australian that actually never really faced bad conditions, winters, because in the season they are here in Europe, it's summer, and then after the season they go back. It's good, you know, there is the positive sides, but I believe that for the character, riding in bad condition makes you a better rider. It's a pain in the ass sometimes. And at the end of the winter, I'm bloody sick of it. Yes. But I believe it makes me a good rider.
I think sometimes as well, having, just from a motivation standpoint, not having everything your own way, like a bit of mandatory time away from doing exactly what you want, it can really recharge your batteries to go ahead and really attack when the spring comes around. Am I right in saying that your dad was sort of, he was definitely a mountain biker. Was he relatively competitive? And I heard a rumor, I don't know if it's absolute bullshit or not. Did your dad and Loic's dad, do they race each other? Is that?
Yeah, they did. Yeah. With Carrie Mamour, Nico Vulios, Jean-Pierre Bruny, and my dad, they all raced together. So it's funny. My dad always stayed in Europe. For racing, he had a really good level. Dura-Salem, European champion he was. He did a lot of BMX racing before that, and then moved into downhill at the end of his career. But I took a lot of inspiration from my dad, because I was always following him at the races, and he made me want to ride a lot my bike and race my bike eventually later.
And what do you think your success has been like for him? Do you think it must be an amazing thing for a father to see their son maybe get just the rung above them than they achieved. It must be a tremendously proud thing for him.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he's really proud and he showed me the way. Obviously, you know, I was always looking at him, always following him at the races when I could. And yeah, just I've always wanted to do the same as him. I've never believed, maybe it's in my character, but I've never really believed that I could one day be a professional in that sport. Because I've always, I think, a little bit underestimated myself in my potential. But then, yeah, when the opportunity came, I couldn't believe it. And yeah, it's been 12 years. I'm living the dream of being a mountain bike athlete in professional sites. So it's good.
Well, because when you did come onto the professional scene, it was on that GT Atherton setup. Mm-hmm. I remember it being flat pedals, which I don't know why, just really, I remember it sounds so stupid, but there were the Shimano shoes, the black ones, which to be honest, weren't anywhere near as grippy as the 510s.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, there's this like up and coming sort of youthful rider, at least give him the grippiest shoes. If he's going to insist on riding flat pedals, trying to make it into to the top level of enduro. It did feel like coming in, you were maybe, you know, along with Richie. It feels like Richie came a bit later on, kind of really established himself on the scene. But you were like the first true enduro prospect from a young age, not someone that's maybe tried other things and ended up in enduro.
Mm-hmm.
Did it feel strange like that? Because obviously you'd been with, I suppose, Dan Atherton when he was giving enduro a crack.
Mm-hmm.
And he's maybe an example of an amazing bike rider that's done so many different things. And you were straight away a specialist in enduro, mm-hmm. who ironically enough is changing to downhill bits and pieces later on.
Yeah.
What was that like going into the Atherton setup, as well as being some, you know, probably quite, I don't know how old you were, but probably quite young, going into this really famous family of successful racers?
It was incredible for me. First of all, I couldn't believe it when I first got the offer and signing my first professional contract with GT, which was a brand I've always looked up to, as my dad was also riding and racing with GTs. And yeah, signing with the Attertons in 2013 was a massive, massive learning curve for me. from trying to speak English, because back then I had no experience with English. So they flew me to Birmingham. Dan Brown picked me up and that's where it all started. From, yeah, trying to speak with them, which was, I have to say, the first 6 months, the most difficult task for me. It was communication, you know, basic communication. But as a young boy, you learn quick. I was 15. So I've learned quick to be able to talk. And yeah, from being able to talk to set up a bike properly, because I had no experience at all. I was just riding fast the bike that I knew back home. It was a Yeti SB66 back then, which was a great bike, but I never really paid attention to the bike setup, as for example. And straight away when I got there, they were like, what handlebar do you ride? What stamp length do you ride? And I had no idea. Mm. I had no answer to give them, you know? There was the GT years. So they were all of them on top of their games.
Yeah.
So I felt sometimes a little bit dumb, stupid, because I knew nothing. I was just trying to ride as fast as I could with a bike that I didn't know. Mm. But I've learned so, so much being surrounded by the Attertons, Dan Brown, the team manager, but also Dan Attertons, which I've spent a lot of years together traveling the world. And I couldn't have asked for a better mentor. Dan was amazing with me. I've always believed he was the best bike riders on the planet. Mm. His style, his aggression on the bike. He's never been a racer, but the way he rides his bike, when I used to follow him and when I still follow him, he's an old dog now, more than 40 years old. But every time I ride behind him, I'm impressed and amazed by the capacity of the man.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, he became a good friend, and I've learned so much from trying some DH as well, because it was an option as they were a downhill team before being an enduro team. Winning 2 times here for William as a junior. My first ever downhill World Cup, I won it here at Fort William. It was like a dream coming true. And yeah, it's been 12 years.
Was there ever any temptation to, after, and we'll talk about, you know, the further success you enjoyed in downhill, but at that young age, you know, I mean, enduro has now already established itself. I think people understand that. I think realistically, when it first happened, it was like, if the best of the best go downhill, and then some people that have a slightly different interpretation of what being the best is end up in enduro, or maybe people that don't want to risk, take the risk on.
Yeah.
Winning those Junior World Cups, was it tempting to, you know, leave sort of the burgeoning enduro scene behind and go to the really established circuit?
It was tempting, but at the same time, living in Belgium, it didn't really allow me back then to ride a downhill bike, because our tracks are not enough of a track, not enough of speed, not enough of elevation to be able to train on a downhill bike. And I was so young that I wasn't even thinking of moving out, you know, and I was really attached to my family, and I'm still very attached to my family. So for me, moving out was never an option. So yeah, it did cross my mind, and it's still sometimes crossing my mind. And maybe eventually in a few years, I will sign a contract only for downhill. Who knows?
Who knows?
Yeah, exactly. And it's a wish for myself. My goal was to win EDR or EWS World Championship. It still didn't happen. Hopefully one day it will happen. And I think when I will get it, hopefully I will be able to focus a little bit more on downhill, because that's, I feel like it's something that I've never really tried. I've never really put all my focus into downhill. It's only sometimes, you know, that I come up, show up and do some downhills, and I'm doing all right, but I believe that I could be much better with a proper, you know, preparation leading to the races.
Well, it's funny you say that, because I do want to talk a bit more about downhill, especially that Le Bresse and Lenzerheide success you enjoyed in 2018. But speaking of not being ready to leave enduro until you won the overall, in Rotorua in 2019, I was doing some freelance work with the Chain Reaction team. And I think it was like Elliot Keelan and maybe JC came home one day. This was like 5 days before the event. And they said, oh my God. They didn't, like, Sam wasn't there. Like, Sam, I don't know, he was like, oh my God, we just bumped into Martin at the petrol station, and we said, you know, are you going to give up now that you won? Now you're world, downhill World Cup winner, and apparently you were just like, not until I've, you know, fucking won an overall, yeah. EWS, and they were like, and he meant business, and everyone was like, oh, which I thought was pretty cool.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, it's always been my goal. First of all, my goal was to win races, things that I've done. But yeah, winning a championship, I've never been able to do it so far. I was so close in 2019. Then unfortunately stuff happened against myself unfairly. But yeah, in 2019 I felt like it was my year, winning the first 3 races, and then not being able to compete for the rest of the season was super, super frustrating. And I still, in a way, carry a little bit of that frustration, because the situation I was in was unfortunately very, very unfair to me.
I think when you won those first 3 rounds, it wasn't necessarily like, it really felt like, I don't know, racers often talk about finding, like unlocking how to win. And it just felt that you were that sort of rung above the competition in that, I think it was like Rotorua, Tasmania. I can't remember what the other round would have been.
Madeira,
yeah.
Mm.
What, in your own words, could you explain the situation to the listeners? Because it's, I'm not going to fill in the gaps. Would you be able to just explain the story?
Yeah. So I was doing a preparation race, in Nelson, 2 weeks before, or it was the week or 2 weeks before Rotorua, the first EWS of the season. And I had a crash. I've cut my leg. So I got stitches the same day from the doctor of the organization. And then, unfortunately, I felt like it wasn't healing the way it was supposed to after getting stitches. And yes, 48 hours, I had to go to the hospital because my leg was getting badly infected. So I went to the hospital. They sent me back to the doctor of the race because that was during practice and the race was still on. So that was Sunday. I drove to the organization where the race was happening and I went to see the doctor. He was like, oh yeah, I can see your leg is getting red, numb. I'm going to remove the stitches, clean it up again, put stitches back on, and I'm going to give you a big dose of antibiotics to fight infection. And I was like, I still remember saying, oh yeah, but I'm racing next week in Rotorua. Those medicines are all right because I will most likely for every race when you finish good position, get tested from the UCI, doping control. He was like, oh yeah, yeah, no problem. But those medicines handed up to be a masking agent. So obviously I won in Rotorua the week after. My leg was healthy, so that was a good start. I could race in Rotorua. Happened, I won, got tested. I was like, oh yeah, I got antibiotics. These are the names of the antibiotics. I was like, oh yeah, fine, fine. And then a couple of weeks after, I got the call from the UCI saying, Mr. Mace, you got a positive test from Rotorua EWS. And for me, it was just, I couldn't believe what was just being said. Yeah, end of the story. The doctor made a mistake. I also made a mistake not checking over, double checking from my side. I was pulled out from any racing for 3 months. And it was such a tough and frustrating situation to face, obviously, because there was obviously no bad attention and no help at the race. Like, it wasn't even a medicine that would help improve my performance, but it was, like I say, a masking agent that was very unfortunate. And after I won in Derby and I won in Madeira, and those wins were cancelled, removed from my result sheets. Things happen. We've learned a lot. I think as a discipline, I've learned a lot personally, also to not only trust the others, but more trust myself, double checking every time I do something, I take something for my health. I think we've all learned a lot from this very unfortunate situation.
As a observer of the sport and a fan of the sport, I would just be really curious what was hurt more? Was it losing the race wins or sort of having your integrity called into question? Because both must be really difficult. Like, I can only imagine you know, seeing the race wins go is one thing, but when people question your character, like universally, you know, it can be really tough, right?
Yeah. I think first of all, I think the race wins being taken away from me wasn't painful. It was more the situation that I was in, the very unfair situation that we've been able to explain through a post on my Instagram and Facebook page that was related to the media in a good way, because we had the writing from the doctor admitting his mistakes. So that was a very good point. Like, he could explain actually exactly what happened And I had photos of my legs being cut. We had the prescription also of the antibiotics that he's given me. So, and it was proven to be, you know, fighting the infection that I was facing at that time. So yeah, it was more being scared of losing a clean image of myself. You know, that was my main concern, you know, because there is always people that only read the subtitle and they see doping, and there is probably still people thinking that I try to dope myself or hide other stuff. Anyways, but that's the past. Now I'm looking ahead. But yeah, there is still that bittersweet of losing. 2019 was a good year for me. Like everything felt like I was on a different cloud. Like you say earlier, the team surrounding me, the bike, my setup on the bike, like everything was rolling. Then I felt like at the races I was just riding fast, but without even trying. Like everything felt natural. And it was such a good positive feeling. It was for me the result of after being professional for a few years. Like obviously I had my few years where I was a loose dog, you know, I was constantly making mistakes, and I felt like 2019 was a year that everything was coming all together, you know, and I felt like I was, on a different cloud, on a different level than the rest of the field. But it wasn't meant to be, you know. Now I look ahead and, you know, after 2019, there was the two COVID years. So I feel like I still haven't properly recovered 100% from that time. And I feel like maybe if one day I win a title, I will be okay with it, you know, anymore. But like I said, there is still that bittersweet that is hurting me sometimes. Yeah.
I know in the scheme of things, this is going to mean absolutely, you know, I'm just some random guy that you met 20 minutes ago. But you don't know what a bad thing kept you from. You know, the dope, like you might have had a horrific crash one of those races that you're allowed to race, and you just don't know.
Exactly. And you know, exactly. I believe in God, and maybe it wasn't meant to be my year. Exactly. I would rather face that situation 100 times than having a bad crash that potentially hand up the rest of my career.
Yeah,
you know?
Totally.
So I'm fine with it. You know, now I've recovered. My mind is free, and I'm ready to tackle this 2024 season the best way possible.
Yeah,
and what's behind is behind, and I just want to look ahead and enjoy the riding.
In those, I think it was maybe 17, 18, 19, maybe or somewhere around that time, it felt like each year, because I think for me, the three sort of really exciting talents at the time who hadn't enjoyed Top Runner's success would be yourself, Adrian Dailly, and Richie Rude felt like he would burn really bright and then not so much. But it felt like between the three of you, you each would take it in turns. Like, it was almost like three friends looking at the biggest guy in the pub and be like, whose turn is it to fight him? And then they'd go and attack Sam Hill.
Yeah.
You know, what was it about Sam that made him so hard to beat? And also, you know, it feels to me from as a fan of the sport that you and Richie kind of did really get to that top rung to, you know, obviously 2019 was and one thing, but then, you know, the World Cup wins or then Richie winning overall titles. But Adrian Dailly really took it to Sam in a way that, I know he had an elbow injury and all this sort of stuff, but why was Sam so hard to beat? And where do you think, like of the three of you, you know, where do you think Adrian's that kind of sits now? I don't know if that's too personal.
Yeah, I think back those years, well, we all know the talent of Sam, and he was flying. He was in good pace. He was motivated. You know, it was so refreshing for him. You know, being at the enduro, he loved the sport. He enjoyed himself. like everything was coming together for him after a few difficult years in downhill. It was really hard to beat, but sometimes only a few seconds were separating us after 30, 40 minutes of racing. So it wasn't unbeatable, but I just felt like it was maybe a mental switch. You know, I needed to beat him to know that I could beat him.
Yes.
You know, and I think that's what happened in 2018 when I first beat him. When he was on top of his game, and then I could then be a bit more in touch straight away, you know, not make those mistakes that I constantly was making. Maybe the speed was good, but maybe I was making too many mistakes compared to him. And yeah, with Richie and Adrian, we were very, very close to each other. One race, it would be Richie in second, the second race will be Adrian that will be on top of his game. Yeah. Adrian was also very motivated at that time and still very young as well. We have the same age with Adrian. But then he had that injury that you were talking about, elbow injury. And since then he didn't really find his mojo. I feel he's an amazing talent. But sometimes I think his mind is playing a little bit with him. Sometimes not motivated enough because he doesn't like the track or it's too physical. Like, I think he's a person that he thinks he's weak physically compared to the others. When there is big liaison, big transfer or physical stages, he's capable to do something very, very good, but he doesn't have the mindset of attacking and knowing that he can actually be a top dog.
Because he's an amazing talent on a bike. You see him riding, it's just...
Yeah, he's been teached with and ridden a lot with Nico Vulios, which is such a legend of the sport and has so many knowledges from the past few decades that he's been riding a bike. So... Adrian is surrounded by great people. But yeah, I think he will come back. He will come back for sure.
When we talk about kind of the supreme confidence that riders get when they really feel like they unlock that top level. Am I right in 2018, I think you won an EWS round and then you went to Libres and won. It must have been... not just for you, but for the whole enduro scene, wildly validating to be like, we came to your party downhill and we won. Yeah. What was that weekend like? And
crazy.
I mean, yeah, talk us through it.
Yeah, so I won Whistler, EWS, and then 2 weeks after there was La Bresse downhill World Cup. And as it wasn't far away from home, I was like, GT, my mechanic was keen also to come over. Like, should we go to La Bresse, try to do something nice? Yeah, we went and ended up winning.
Was the intention to go and mix it with the top 10 or was it?
No, not at all. Like I knew that the track was suiting me pretty well and also the horrendous condition. That day in finals, it was pissing down. It was really the same condition that we faced all the winter in Belgium.
Right.
So actually, I felt like at home. And mentally, I was ready to play in the mud. You know, like once, I think other people, like from the south, coming to La Bresse and seeing such a shit weather in August, they were like, you know, they lose motivation.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, but I was happy to go in the mud and go as fast as possible. And it was also a track where I would say that settings didn't really matter as much because, you know, we faced really dry condition. And then on Sunday, you know, everything was completely different. And the track, the gradient, the roughness, it wasn't like for William, as an example, or Mont-Saint-Anne, where the speed is high, the suspension needs to be right, you need a lot of time on your bike to be comfortable. La Bresse was none of that. You know, it was just about riding your bike as fast as possible down the hill in horrendous conditions.
Because I think you probably got the accolade of being one of the few elite sportsmen to win a world championship level event in waterproof trousers. Yeah. That's quite impressive.
Yeah, and actually,
I thought you were going to go catch some salmon afterwards, you know?
No, but for the story, I hate being on the roller and warm up on the roller on my bike.
Right.
So what happened is that day, I've put my knee brace on, I've put my racing pants, and over, I've put my rain pants. I went to warm up in the field on top of La Bresse, and it was like so windy and so rainy that I say to Mark Morrison, my mechanic back then, I was like, I'm going to keep it on. I'm going to keep it on. It's so freezing that I don't feel like taking it out, and ended up winning my first downhill World Cup with a rain pants and a rain jacket as well.
Yeah. I mean, when you go to top, often, you know, when we talk about World Cup racing, the thing I'll always tell people in terms of my recommendation for what they could see on a World Cup weekend, I think one of the coolest things is seeing, maybe not for the race, but for qualifying, seeing how athletes get into the top, the final little special compartment of their brain, you know, where it's like ultimate fight or flight. Like, especially, you know, mountain biking racing, we normalize it because we're also used to it, but it can be something quite dangerous. And, you know, to win a World Cup downhill, you kind of have to be prepared to override a lot of fear, a lot of reasons telling you not to do something. What was it like getting into that space in La Bresse? And was it maybe easy that it was kind of wet and there were kind of distractions? Because, I don't know, coming from enduro where it's maybe more, I don't know, it'd be interesting to hear what you say, but it feels like enduro, obviously, you have to go incredibly fast, and but you don't have to go to that 99.9% of the absolute potential.
Yeah. In enduro, it's true that you can have a decent stage, losing a bit of time, not feeling like you're flying, but still have a good stage because you haven't made any mistake and you've been consistent from top to bottom. In downhill, there is no room for error. There is no room for hesitation. And when you get into that zone, I call it the zone, which only happens a few times a year, then everything flows. There is no more hesitation. You look so far ahead and you don't actually see the risk or the danger on the tracks, you know? And definitely, like, looking back at my best stages or races, like, I was in that zone, but you don't know how it comes. You don't know how it goes away. But I would like to have that technique to every time be in the zone for every stage and every downhill walk-ups that I do, every runs that I do. But it's hard to get in there, you know. It's hard to get in there. It's a mix, I think, of confidence, fitness, mindset, that comes all together.
You mentioned, you know, words like mindset a lot already. Is that something that you work on off the bike? That's something you get an opportunity to sort of coach and train?
Yeah, I'm working with a sport psychologist for a few years that has been helping me massively. You know, it's a hard sport. You risking big injuries, sometimes your life at the speed that we're going in downhill and enduro these days. You have a family back home. You know, it's your job. So if you have a big injuries, it's potentially the end of it completely. So the idea is not to think about it, but there are some times where obviously you're facing the truth. So that's where a sport psychologist that you can talk to can help you out a lot in those situations to overcome those situations. And when it comes race day or the race run, you absolutely do 100% abstraction of those things and just focus on what you can do on the bike.
When we look back, you know, so we move on from, you know, you said that maybe setup wasn't so important because of the the changeable nature of the track, but somewhere where we know that setup is very important and the times the racing is often very tight is Lenzerheide. And you were what? I think it was something, it was like 0.3 or something.
Yeah, 0.2 behind Loic.
0.2 behind Loic. Mm. You know, silver medal, world champs. That track wasn't changeable. And that track, I mean, it might have been slippy because maybe the dust was so fine it got a bit slippy, but you know what I mean? It was it was a true summer World Cup condition. In some ways, how do you compare the feeling between winning a World Cup on sort of that changeable wet track compared to being 0.2 behind someone who is in the intervening years showing themselves to be a generational talent on a dry track?
Yeah, I think after La Bresse, I came full of confidence. But also, I wanted to... There was a lot of doubt about my performance in La Bresse.
From external voices?
Yeah, just because a lot of people were thinking that the condition changed drastically from the time that I did my race run. It stopped raining a little bit and... Some riders were saying that the mud was a little bit more sticky when they came down. You know, there is always excuses.
There's always something.
So, but good point is that those excuses really pissed me off. Yeah. And I wanted to prove 2 weeks after in Lanzarote that it wasn't by any coincidence or luck that I got there, you know. And yeah, Lanzarote, I was full of confidence. And I was ready to show to the people that I was capable to do it on the dry track, somewhere else,
somewhere far from home as well.
The World Championship, which is, you know, the main goal for every downhill racers every year. So yeah, good times. I had a lot of fun, and hopefully I can repeat, you know, those feelings and those performance on a downhill bike again, because, you know, the excitement of downhill racing is something that I've missed over the last few years. And it's a discipline that I truly love through my heart.
When we sort of, you know, come into, I suppose it's 2022, you started riding for Bear. You enjoyed so much success on GT. Everything, the only change is change. What was it like leaving that GT setup, and what was the reasoning that you could go into? I mean, was it just that you wanted to mix it up?
Yeah, after 9 years being with the same brand, it was maybe time for me to move on to something new. With GT, like my surrounding, my mechanic, also the bikes, everything was great. I didn't have complaint, but the turnovers of the bikes, like evolutions on the bike, was very, very slow. Sometimes a little bit too slow for me, because I wanted to always be on top of the game. And it got to a point where I felt like I didn't have the bike that I wanted. And the turnover was in 2 years' time. So I didn't see myself riding that bike for 2 more years. The downhill bike was also getting a little bit old, and I knew that there was another 2 years to do with that bike. So I guess that was the only thing for me that I didn't like with GT. Except from that, like I said, the surrounding, the vibe inside the team, working with Mark Morrison, my mechanic, that lived really close to my house as well, was allowing us to improve every week, go testing in Belgium, and everything was super easy. But yeah, it was time for me to make the changes. And Orbea was a very innovative brand, keen to follow me on my dream and expectation, which was racing some EWS the full season, achieve my goal with them, but also do some appearance in downhill. And they were super keen to do that, super motivated. So I felt like it was the right time for me to move on from GT and join also a European brand that was more accessible for me, close to my house, and just a little flight, and I get to Malabia at Orbea, and I went to visit the factory, tested the bike, and I was convinced that it was time to move on and join Orbea, which I have absolutely no regrets.
I feel like you chose the word appearance then very carefully. You know, in 2022 in Lourdes, for instance, it would be fair to say that you did appear at the World Cup, but you were doing so on a modified enduro bike. It's super cool. I mean, this will, I think this will probably come out the week after Fort William, where people have seen you ride this modified, longer travel, non-e-bike, even though it's got sort of the chassis of an e-bike. Mm-hmm. From a lover of the sport in 2022 in Lourdes, I was thinking, peel the stickers off a downhill frame and give them a bloody downhill bike. Is that noise, I don't know, like, do you find that sort of commentary helpful, or do you just consider it noise? Because actually, you know what you're there to do, and you've made the arrangement with Orbea. Like, you know, it's your business. It's not actually none of my business.
Yeah.
Do you think it's like, wow, these people really want me to be on the best kit to show what I can do? Or that's a distraction because I've got these bigger goals and this is just an appearance, like you said?
Yeah. Obviously, when comes to a race, we always want to do our best with the product that we have. So we know in Lourdes, we knew that we were not able to be competitive because we have no experience with that bike. Actually, the experience we had with that bike, because that was the enduro bike, modified with more travel. But with the OLAP project and Orbea, the goal is to experience stuff, you know, to potentially see those evolution into a future enduro bike, e-bike, or elsewhere, you know. Mm. So the goal is never to perform straight away, but to see what we are able to do on a modified frame, adapted to the discipline. So yeah, in Lourdes we were competitive. Came here in 2022 at Fort William. Unfortunately, I got sick. I wasn't able to race. And we knew that for the project that we had with the Ryland back then, that track would be very, very difficult because the kinematic wasn't progressive enough. Mm. But unfortunately, we didn't have time to experience more that year. But still got a top 20, I think, in Lourdes that year in 2022 with an enduro bike that was modified. Was pretty good, actually. And yeah, here we are, 2024, 2 years later, for William with a completely different project. Only 3 days of riding on that bike. Seems to be working, but you never know before you come to a proper racetrack, proper downhill course, especially like here in Fort William. The track is brutal.
Brutal. Long.
Long.
It's got everything
to make
it. Super
demanding. So we will see what we're capable to do with that bike, but the first 3 days were promising.
So now this is, I mean, I'm looking at the e-bike you will be riding this weekend. So non-modified bike.
Based on the e-bike.
Based on the e-bike.
The Wild.
How tall are you? Because this is a mixed wheel bike that I'm looking at. I think a lot of the success you enjoyed in 2019, that was with a smaller rear wheel in a 29. Was it the mixed wheel sort of you were pursuing, or was it a way to maybe just bring the geometry with more in line with what you wanted? And when you race on your Rayon, is it full 29 or is it 650?
650 back and 29 on the front.
And so is that something you, because it was interesting, and I don't know, for me, I felt, being someone that's sort of an observer in the media, I suppose, that there are a lot of bike brands putting smaller rear wheels in the same frame. And we've done something amazing just because they've made the changes that people have been asking them to make for years, and they've just sacrificed the seat tube angle, which has now got very slack. Was that, although you like riding mixed wheel bikes now, was that GT more about getting the angles right, or was it about incorporating the smaller rear wheel?
No, we just wanted to try something different because there was, once again, no more evolution on that bike. And we were like, we going towards 29er markets. Some bikes are also very competitive in downhill and 29er. 29er is not the way to go for me. Has never been really the way to go because I have a long torso, but shorter legs. So every time I ride on a 29er back wheels, I feel like I don't have space enough to move on the bike.
How tall are you? Sorry, just for the listener.
I'm 1.83 meters.
I'm 1.83 as well.
Yeah.
And I have the exact same problem.
Yeah.
I'm just on the cusp. I just can't
have fun. Yeah. I think for me that was the only thing. Like maybe sometimes the bike, I felt like the bike was efficient, but I didn't feel like I was right at home on that bike. I didn't have fun. I couldn't move enough. And the back wheel was constantly kicking my ass, which wasn't a good feeling. Mm. So I remember in Lusa at the beginning of 2019, we had that GT Force in 650. And my mechanic, which has a lot of experience, was like, let's try something. We're going to reduce the fork travel at the front of 20 millimeters, put a 29er wheels at the front, offset bearings as well to compensate a little bit the geometry, and let's just try it. So we were switching bikes with my mechanic. He was also riding, did one run, 650, full 650 with the Force. We swapped, we didn't say anything. After four runs, I was like, Mark, this is fun, efficient, gives you a lot of confidence. And that bike feels like it was made to ride like this. You know, and we were the first to race a mullet bike at the EWS in 2019, and now it's the majority that is either on mullet or 29er.
When we look forward to this season, so Fort William, will you be in Poland, or will it start to get too many, will it get many calendar conflicts going forward? Do you know your schedule, or you kind of make it up as you go along?
So the schedule, the plan for this coming 2024 season is to do three downhill World Cups. So the plan is to do Fort William here, Mont Saint-Anne at the end of the season, and also the World Championship in Val-Nord. So that's the DH plan that we are planning with Olab and Aubert. And at the same time, the main focus remains EDR. Like the full season, trying to be as consistent as I can and perform my best with the bike, the Ralen. I truly love the bike. I found the setup that I wanted on that bike, it seems like. I'm also working with a new mechanic that lives close to my house, which is Jill Franks, and I'm capable to do much more testing than I've been doing the last 2 years, also with that bike and with Aubert. So that's a lot of positive changes for the future. And I'm really looking forward to this season. I feel like I've never been so ready.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for your time. It's been great to hear your sort of insight into so many aspects. And yeah, best of luck this weekend.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
Welcome back. Thank you for that podcast, Henry. Really interesting to listen to Martin Mays. And yeah, we'll see him in action. Finale Liguri this weekend kicks off the Enduro World Cup. And then again in Poland, there's another round. So that round will be downhill and Enduro back to back. So, you know, he could probably do all the Enduro, the e-bike race, and the downhill race all on that one bike if he wanted, but I think we'll just see him focusing on Enduro for now. So that was great. And yeah, let's get into Music Corner, since you guys are the two music experts here. Mike, you have you're an extra music expert now, I hear. You have your own radio show, is that what you just said?
Yeah, I convinced them to let me be on the radio now. So here in Bellingham, there's like a low power FM station, so now I have a slot on Tuesday.
It's even
nights.
Named after him.
It kind of, it's KZAX, so it's not KCAS yet, but people can listen Tuesday nights 9 to 11. You could listen on their internet too. It's got internet radio, so.
Oh, wow. wet, yeah. so we can listen to you even if we're not within a 5 kilometer radius.
Exactly. Yeah, Dvorak is like just like downtown, basically. You can hear it, but it's super fun. I just go in a basement and then play music for 2 hours, so it's great.
Wow, yeah. That's cool. You have 2 hours worth of music. Holy moly.
Well, it is kind of hard. Each week I have to like make the playlist. I'm like, oh, it's no, I gotta make sure. Thing. Yeah, it's like, yeah. Oh god, I gotta play cool stuff. And like, yeah, it's wow. it's fun though. I'm excited for it. So
what was the coolest thing you played this week?
I didn't play this yet. I will play this eventually though. But there's this band that I found called Clowncore. And I don't like clowns to begin with. Like clowns are scary. But this music video is these guys driving around in a Toyota Previa with synthesizers inside the Previa and a saxophone, and they're wearing clown masks. And it's just like a joke group that's making like almost really good music. And you have to watch the video, but
yeah. Mike and I went and rode the North Shore this weekend, and on the way back, he played this, and our other friend in the car asked if the stereo was broken.
Yeah, like it just keeps repeating. So this is it's more of a joke pick this week, but the actual people in the band, they like semi hide their identities, but they are actually very talented jazz musicians. They're like more like avant-garde jazz. So it's a really weird sub story, but if you watch the video and have any interest, follow it down the internet rabbit hole, because it's pretty interesting. So Clowncore,
your computer's not broken. If
it's not broken, right. Yeah. Well, I'll do
lean in. It's yeah, not broken.
I'll do Flat Earth will be the song I'll stick in, but yeah, it's pretty good.
Nice, Dario. What do you got?
I'm gonna recommend a song called "Confidence Consciousness" by MS Paint. Just it fits into my noisy and grumbly tune diaspora. So.
Nice. MS Paint. Like
MS Paint.
Like
yeah.
what you did to like make circles and like squiggly yeah. lines.
Microsoft is currently
it sounds it's like lo-fi enough that it sounds like it was made on MS Paint in a way.
Amazing. These sound like two great choices. Guys. Yeah,
just easy listening, just like sit back. No, mine's
a song. It's song-like. Yeah.
Okay, well, mine actually has like lyrics and stuff. It's by Robin, who's a Swedish singer-songwriter. And,
like R-O-B-Y-N, Robin?
R-O-B-Y-N, yep.
Yeah.
Not spelled like the bird. But anyways, I was just thinking energy-wise, I feel like she has some good pump-up music that like the World Cup broadcaster team should listen to before. Drink some yeah. Red Bull, listen to yeah. some Robin, and then, yeah, report to us back from Poland. So, yeah, looking yeah. forward to watching that next race with a little bit more energy. So,
oh, yeah. yeah.
Thanks for joining me, guys.
I'm gonna stoke them up. I'm gonna put like a Bluetooth speaker playing Darude Sandstorm behind them, just on yeah. repeat, so they're like
just a little more, a little more energy
up for the race. Yeah.
Sweet, awesome. Well, yeah. Hope everybody enjoyed the podcast, and we will talk to you soon.